or that job role has, which I think is important to some students to know whether they're wanting to go into industry or go a different direction. And then teamwork and collaborative interaction is, as I said, very important. This becomes a collection of new experiences, and because of that, it kind of goes back up to step one here where we talked about the application process and interviewing. It gives them a source of some examples for what we call situational interviewing. And more and more, as students go out into the workforce, one of the things that they get bowled over by a bit is that it's very rare when a student or a candidate for a position is asked a straightforward question about, you know, are you a good leader, or are you a real go-getter. It's more presented to them in the form of, you know, we value teamwork in our organization. Give me an example of a time when you were in a team and you worked in a way that you felt like you were really productive in a team situation, and tell me about that. That's the way the question gets asked, and this kind of a job opportunity or work research opportunity gives them some fodder to answer those kind of questions with some examples beyond what they're going to gain in the academic setting. It gives them exposure to lots of things relative to experimental approach, and I can't impress upon you how key this is, and I was glad to hear from Wyatt and some others that they're actually teaching this at the undergraduate level. Even at the PhD level, when we look for talent that we want to hire out there, to find a student that can design a good experiment, analyze it well, and then take that analysis and relate that to what's happened in the literature and what's happened in concurrent research that may be going on with other people around the country, and make a sense out of what that means, is a very rare thing. Seems like a very basic thing, and what we're finding is that it's the good students that can do those things are associated with a specific teacher, professor, or program, and not necessarily with any one school. So I'm glad to hear that that's happening at the undergrad level. It's something that's very, very important in the private sector. So the other things that it's going to do, I heard critical thinking skills mentioned. I think through this kind of an experience and sort of a broad bit of exposure to a lot of things, it should help with some of those critical thinking skills and problem solving. It's going to help enhance their non-technical skills or transferable skills, and this is something that I really don't think is taught much, and I would encourage that as you have opportunities to expose your students to, you know, places where they can show leadership, places where they can be involved in some team type work, accountability, creativity, communication, and then flexibility or that breadth of knowledge is extremely important, and we hope that these kind of opportunities do that. We always have an end of experience write-up and kind of a formal presentation that each student is asked to give internally to our company. A lot of times those can roll into these papers or posters that are then taken externally as well, but before they leave and go back to school, we want to make sure that they have tied the thing up with a bow and that there's something there of concrete value that they can tell us about what they did and why they did it and what it meant. And so those experiences are important, and as I said, they get leveraged into these papers and posters. Hopefully they have some perspective that can help define then their career interests. You know, they may do this and have a great summer and be the best intern we've ever had and go back to school and say, nah, don't think that's for me, and that's fine. That's exactly what these are for. The flip side of that is it also gives us a wonderful opportunity to screen these students early. As I said, on a talent team, we are always looking for students, and we're not necessarily looking for them the day we have a job opening. We track a lot of students very early in the process. And you can see here it says that we often, our hire candidates are often identified 1 to 2 years in advance, and we screen them, and we track them, and we recruit them. And we use internships as one of the tools that we have in place to look at people at kind of the early side of the career, particularly those that are going on into graduate programs. It demonstrates to us a genuine interest by the student that they really want to do the kind of work that we're involved in. You know, sometimes if they've been through an internship and they actually come back and apply for a job later, that tells you they know what they're getting into, and there's probably a higher bet that you're not going to lose them as an employee that's dissatisfied a couple of years down the road because they kind of know where they're headed. And it may have an impact on starting salaries. When a student has 2 or 3 internships, when we hire them, sometimes we can look at that as real work experience, and they may actually come in as an employee with a year of experience versus an employee that's green and right out of school. Not always. There's no promises to that, but depending on, you know, the quality of the internships that they've had, we certainly do give credit for those things. And then kind of as a last slide, when we think about the research experience, this is something that kind of came out of sort of our talent team search, and it's what we look for when we're looking for kind of that candidate that we eventually hire someday, and it stands out among his or her peers as being competent and motivated, provides positive perspective on entomology as his or her chosen profession, and understands how the research can improve agriculture and pest management, and understands the critical issues for the future. And those are things we try to give them as part of this undergraduate research program. That's it. Any questions?
Squarrow snapweed. We're one of the two states in the nation with really large amounts of squarrows, Utah being the first. This is a really neat picture I like to show with Yellow Star, our greatest snapweed on the far right, and then Bachelor Button right next to it, followed by Diffuse, then Squarrows and Spotted Knapweed, just to give you a perspective of the size of the different seed heads. In each case, I mean, I collected all five of those within about a 200-yard section near a lumber yard. Diffuse Knapweed is primarily a roadside weed for California. Our biocontrol site is somewhat of a roadside up in deep in marijuana country up in Trinity County. Spotted knapweed is primarily also a roadside weed, with the exception of the location where we're doing biocontrol, which is a riparian zone. Been a little bit too hard for them to spray it out. And squirrel snapweed is the larger in terms of the area that it occupies. Each of the infestation for squirrels for us is a substantial infestation. Squirrels is not common for a lot of the other states in the western U.S., but it does produce huge numbers of seed heads, which retain the seeds, drop on the ground, get carted all over, and you can get some really nice infestations. This is one of my research sites. So a typical thing for one of the lessons that we learned, some insects never build to substantial levels. Torrelia virens, you know, it's a real pretty fly, and we released it on spotted knapweed at a couple different locations along our plot, and it just never builds up. It's just there. It's kind of interesting, but it never builds up to any level to be of value. Some other things that we've learned over the course of time is what works in Montana and Canada doesn't necessarily work in California. Really kind of a no-brainer. The example I want to mention are the root insects on spotted. Agapita, we released way back in 1993 or whatever it was, 1994. It's really gone nowhere for us. We can find a few roots that are attacked, but they're just gradually fading out. It's really been a kind of a non-functional agent for us. Cyphocleonis, likewise, has not been a major player on our spotted knapweed. Even though these numbers may look high, you know, that we may have 50% of those of the three sites that I have there, some years it would get up to 50% of the roots that were attacked. Most of those attacks are 3, 4, 5 year old. You know, these are not current attacks. In terms of current attacks, these numbers are really going way down. So the root agents for us have generally not been of any value. Insects find their hosts. What I find really impressive is how some of the insects have flown so far without anything in between. Urophora quadrifasciata has never introduced intentionally into California. It has flown there from presumably Oregon over some, you know, nearly 100 miles distance to reach these isolated populations of knapweed, to reach our squirrels populations, to reach our spotted populations. So it was already there by the time we started looking for it. Another one I find very interesting is Eustenopus villosus, the hairy weevil. This is a Yellow Star agent. And it's interesting what has happened with that. It has moved, hopping along on Yellow Star until it reached a place where we have Yellow Star next to spotted. And so now it has become a fairly good agent on spotted knapweed. So I can find it, you know, feeding on spotted knapweed buds, ovipositing. It chews on the seeds, produces the typical callus that we get on yellow star, but it does it on spotted knapweed, and it actually will go through its full life cycle, and we've had some adults emerge on spotted knapweed. So if, you know, they will find a reasonable host given time. Another generalization is that some agents significantly affect other agents. The examples I want to bring in are the ones for us from diffuse knapweed. For us, diffuse knapweed, we released, or the people preceding me released Giraffra, the gall fly, way back in 1976. They released it, they walked away, never really dealt with it. And then we started working on the back at that site in 1994 when we released the two seed head weevils. So the galls, of course, it should be a nice hard gall, but right now, if you go into our diffuse knapweed locations, almost every one of the galls will be chewed up, kind of ripped to bits, either by Bangosternis or Larinus. Giraffra was released in 1976, and nearly 20 years later, when we came there to put the seed head weevils, Giraffra had never built up to any levels, any significant levels. It had never gotten over 20% of the seed heads. It was just there. And then once we released the seed head weevils, Giraffra is just really being pushed out. So it was not a great agent anyway, and the weevils have pretty much chewed it up. But those two weevils are having their own little interaction. We put Bangosternis there first, then the next year we added Larinus, and it's Bangosternis got a little bit of a head start. It's our blue graph, or blue bars, but Larinus, over the course of time, seems to, on diffuse snapweed, be taking over from Bangosternis. It's kind of interesting when I don't have a graph to show you this, but on squirrel snapweed, it's the opposite. Bangosternis is sort of taking over for Larinus. So those two weevils occupy the same niche, but they do compete. Host range studies do not necessarily predict impact. It's kind of everyone knows that, but the squirrel snapweed was never listed as a primary host of any of the knapweed agents that were released in the United States. They either said spotted knapweed, spotted and diffuse, or they said knapweeds. But squirrels was never chosen as a real target for that. In some of the agents, squirrels would have been tested. More likely than in most cases, they would just look at the literature and see that, oh, these things have been seen feeding around squirrels. Nonetheless, we tried to put most of these agents on squirrels, and they actually, you would assume from the literature that they were not a big player on squirrels, but I think at least three of these agents are more important on squirrels knapweed or more effective on squirrels than they ever were on the other knapweeds. As an example, this is just from five different years, seed production in the absence of any agents are the green bars. If Giraffra quadrifasciata is there only in those seed heads, you can see the drastic reduction in seeds per seed head. The two weevils, if either of them is there by themselves, there's essentially no seed production. Population density matters. The squirrel snapweed situation really shows us that. If Giraffra is there all by itself, it'll take out 70 to 80% of the seed in the seed heads that it attacks. It's really significant in the seed heads that it attacks. Our problem is that of the 10 sites where we've done most of our work, we never get more than about 6.5% attack. So only 6.5% of those seed heads are attacked by an insect that does real well. So you're never going to get anywhere with that particular insect. On the other hand, the two seed head weevils, Larinus minutus, Bangosternis fausti, they actually have a greater impact on seed production in the seed heads that they're there. They take it down to about a tenth or about a thousandth of the seed production from a clean head. But what's more important is that they build to huge populations in a very, very short time. This is just a summary of, six of the sites that I followed from the time that we first released those seed head weevils. We would look, in a matter of 2 to 3 years, we would end up with 90% of the seed heads that are attacked by one or the other of those weevils. That's in 2 to 3 years. And they're just exploding. And obviously, if they're taking out 99.9% of the seed from the heads that they attack, we're having huge impacts on seed production with squirrel snapweed. It's orders of magnitude greater than anything we saw with the spotted or diffuse. When I look at the three knapweeds that I've been working with and compare it with yellowstar thistle, and I look at this because some of the weevils are pretty similar, there are some issues that about size and size that matters. This is some squirrel snapweed seed heads that are attacked by, in this case, that's probably probably Larinus. Basically, Larinus and Bangasternus clean those seed heads out. There's nothing left. There's absolutely nothing left in there. And you can picture how that is when you look at, say, a Bangasternus on the left-hand side here. There's our squirrel snapweed seed head. And Larinus on the right-hand side. They basically are shoulder. Their shoulders are the full wall-to-wall inside that head. So they really end up chewing up everything. You compare that, the seed head size, to a squirrel on the left, diffuse in the middle, and spotted on the right. And you can see that those weevils are going to have a little, you can assume that the weevils would have a little different effect. Those are the dried seed heads from the one you saw before. A very large yellow star thistle, that's kind of traditional size, next to a spotted knapweed, which is a pretty substantial. And then the next to the left one is our squirrels, a very small little head, and diffuse on the far left. So we did some calculations from some of our best results. And if we take, for instance, Eustanopus, which is the best weevil we have on yellow star thistle, which is from the bottom line on here, yellow star thistle with a mean diameter, a fairly large head, mean diameter of over 6 millimeters in diameter, the very best we get is about 69% of the seed that are destroyed when Eustanopus is there in those heads. So big head, the best weevil takes out 69% of the seed. We go to our next largest of the knapweed seed heads, which is spotted from the top one. This one is just short of 5 millimeters in diameter. When Larinus is there, under our situation, Larinus takes out about 75% of the seed for those seed heads that it's present in. On the other hand, diffuse knapweed, a smaller seed head, substantially smaller, Larinus is taking out just short of 94% of the seed. And finally, with squirrels, the smallest of the seed heads, less than 3 millimeters in diameter on an average. Whenever Larinus is there, it's taking out 99.8% of the seed. And since it builds up to these huge populations anyway, we essentially have no seed production in our squirrel snapweed sites. And all three of these knapweeds, we're having some nice results over the course of time, like I've already been mentioned, about population levels. This is our diffuse knapweed site, where the blue line is the total percentage of seed heads that are attacked by one agent or another. And over the course of those years, you can see that somewhere around 1998, 1999, we started seeing some declines in the population of diffuse knapweed. That was about 5 years after we started releasing the seed head weevils. Spotted, it took much longer, probably 7 years before we start to see some declines in the spotted density. In that case, spotted, we do not have Bangasternus, by the way. That's just Larinus is the only seed head agent. For the squirrel snapweed one, these happen much, much faster. 2 to 3 years, we start to see some impacts on populations. It's really a function in that case of how long it takes for the mature plants to age out, because they don't really kill anything. And for us in California, Larinus is generally not doing a lot of adult feeding. Squirros is the only one that I see any adult feeding on. It has not been feeding on, doing a lot of adult feeding on spotted or diffuse, but I really see it on squirros and knapweed. And a couple of sites, multiple plots in each site, squirros, knapweed, the density of the bolting plants and everything just goes down real, real fast. Another kind of generalization from the three knapweeds is I'm not very fond of the gall flies. They're neat insects, but they don't do a lot.